A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know the image. President at the Resolute desk. Flags behind him. Cameras clicking. He signs a bill with like 12 pens and hands them out as souvenirs. It's practically the visual shorthand for American executive power. But here's the thing that got me thinking. That room is an actual office. Someone's email gets answered there. Coffee gets spilled on that rug.
Right, because the signing ceremony is pure theater. The lighting's set, the angles are chosen, the family members and congressional leaders are arranged just so. It's designed to be seen.
And that got me thinking about something I put together a while back. A custom photo album of world leaders in their offices. About 30 or 40 photographs, pulled from Reddit and various corners of the internet. Candid shots, official ones, some where they clearly didn't know a camera was on them.
So the desk is literally a diplomatic artifact before it's even furniture.
Of course it is. A desk with a resume. Then you flip the page and there's Netanyahu's office. Oddly austere, small wooden desk, barely any decoration. It's like the frugal ethos of early Israel just froze in time. And then my favorite, the late Queen Elizabeth, working at what looks like a side table in a hotel room. A single lamp, a stack of papers, no heraldry, no throne, just a woman doing paperwork.
That photograph is genuinely striking. I remember you showing me that one. She could have been a mid-level manager at a regional insurance firm.
He put together a custom photo album of about 35 images of heads of state in their offices, and the questions it raises are surprisingly practical. Do these people actually use these rooms? The CEOs? The heads of state? The people whose offices we see in these photographs? Are they sitting there at 8 in the morning with coffee and a briefing book? Or do they sweep in for 12 minutes, sign 3 things, and leave?
Because if they're purely symbolic, then we're analyzing the design equivalent of a film set.
And if they're real, then the layout of these rooms. The distance between the desk and the guest chairs, the sight lines from the door, whether there's a side table for actual work versus the big desk for show, all of that starts to matter in a very practical way. So Daniel sent us this prompt, and he's essentially asking 3 things. First, do world leaders and CEOs actually spend meaningful time in these iconic offices, or are they just stage sets? Second, do any of these high-ranking people actually care about ergonomics and office design, or are those details beneath them? And third, who designs these spaces anyway? Given the security and anti-surveillance requirements, it's clearly not your average interior decorator.
That third question is where this gets interesting, because you're right. You can't just hire someone from a design magazine spread. These are spaces with Faraday cages, acoustic dampening, blast-resistant materials. The person picking the desk also has to think about electromagnetic shielding.
Which is not a concern I have in my workspace, but I appreciate that someone does, so there's a lot to unpack here. The photo album is our primary source, weird as that sounds, and I think it tells us more than most official architecture tours ever would.
Let's define the scope before we dive into individual offices. We're not just talking about the Oval Office here. We're looking at executive workspaces of heads of state, the German Chancellery, the Israeli Prime Minister's Office, the Moroccan Palace, Buckingham Palace, 10 Downing Street. And the album gives us something you don't get from official architecture tours, or at least less staged ones. A leader at their desk reading a document, not looking at the camera. You can tell when someone's actually working versus when they've been posed. The posture changes, the papers are spread differently.
The coffee cup is in the wrong place for a photo op. That kind of thing.
And what hits you immediately flipping through those 30 or 40 photographs is how wildly these spaces vary. Not in terms of opulence, though that varies too, but in layout, in the sense of formality, in whether the room even seems usable for sustained work.
The Queen's side table is the extreme end of that. It's almost aggressively unceremonial. You look at it and think, this is where she actually worked. Not the throne room, not the audience chamber, not any of the places you'd associate with the crown. This little table with a lamp and some papers.
Then on the opposite end you have the German chancellery. Massive, wide, airy. The desk is positioned with what I can only describe as a conspicuously large gap between the workstation and the guest seating area.
It's the architectural equivalent of, please maintain a respectful distance.
Which is very German, honestly. German business culture has a strong norm around personal space and formal distance. You don't get close to someone you're negotiating with. The office layout mirrors that.
The room itself is doing diplomatic work before anyone opens their mouth.
That's exactly what I think is happening. And it's not unique to Germany. You see it across the album. The distance between the leader's desk and the guest chairs is a kind of silent signal. Some offices have the chairs pulled right up to the desk. Others create a whole zone of empty floor between them.
The Moroccan Palace office was the opposite. Ornate, layered, almost enclosing. You feel wrapped in the space rather than standing at a remove from it.
Which tells you something about how different cultures conceive of power. Is it something you project outward across distance, or something you draw people into?
And that's what this episode is really about. It's not just a design tour. It's the intersection of power, culture, and actual human work habits at the highest level. Do these people sit down and read briefing books? Do they take phone calls at that desk? Or is the real work happening in some back office we never see?
The reason this matters for our audience, for anyone listening who isn't a head of state, is that office design and ergonomics are almost always discussed in the context of ordinary workplaces. Cubicles, open plan offices, home setups. But the people who could have literally anything, any desk, any chair, any layout, any designer, often choose surprisingly mundane configurations.
Or they don't choose at all. Some of these offices look like nobody's thought about the ergonomics since the building was constructed.
Which is either reassuring or alarming, depending on how you look at it.
I'm going with reassuring. If the Queen can run the Commonwealth from what looks like a hotel writing desk, my setup is probably fine.
The album is a quirky primary source, but it's a real one. These aren't curated architectural photographs. They're snapshots gathered from Reddit and Internet archives. Some are official, some are clearly taken by staff or visitors. A few are press pool shots where the leader is caught mid-task. As a dataset, it's not systematic, but it's honest in a way that official portraits aren't.
It lets us ask questions that official sources don't usually answer. Like, does anyone at this level actually care about their chair?
I think some of them do, actually. Kennedy's the famous case. He had a custom rocking chair in the Oval Office. His back was a mess, chronic pain from the war and from Addison's disease. The rocking chair wasn't a decorative choice. It was a medical intervention disguised as furniture.
A rocking chair in the Oval Office. You picture it and it sounds almost absurd, but apparently it worked.
It did, and his doctors recommended it specifically. The chair was built by a craftsman in North Carolina, and Kennedy used it so consistently that it became part of his public image. But the point is, he brought his ergonomic needs into the most symbolically loaded room in the country. He didn't hide the chair in a back office.
Which is the opposite of what most leaders do. The Queen's side table we talked about. That was clearly her actual workspace, tucked away in a private room. The throne, the audience chamber, those are the performance spaces. She separated them completely.
That separation is the pattern. Obama was known to work from the Oval Office, but he also used the treaty room down the hall for smaller meetings and late-night reading. The Oval Office was for the big moments and the daily flow of scheduled work. The treaty room was for thinking.
You've got three modes, really. The performance space for cameras and ceremony, the official workspace for scheduled meetings, and then the hidden workspace where the actual reading and decision-making happens.
Merkel was similar. Her staff described her as using the chancellery office heavily for reading and preparation, not just photo ops. She'd sit there with briefing books, making notes. But she also had a reputation for working from a standing desk in her private office, which nobody photographed.
Which brings us to the ergonomics question directly. You mentioned Kennedy. Roosevelt had the entire Oval Office layout redesigned for his wheelchair. The desk height, the turning radius, the placement of everything. And that was 1934. Nobody was talking about workplace accessibility then, but the president needed it, so it happened.
Then you have Churchill, who was the anti-ergonomics case. His desk was famously cluttered, papers stacked everywhere, ashtrays overflowing. He worked from bed half the time. His staff would bring him documents, and he'd dictate from under the covers. No interest in chair design whatsoever.
The man ran a war from his pajamas.
And that's the thing. Ergonomics at this level is entirely personality-driven. There's no head of state ergonomics consultant who shows up and says, "Sir, your lumbar support is inadequate." If the leader cares, it happens. If they don't, it doesn't.
Trudeau's been photographed with a standing desk. Macron has a very modern, almost startup CEO setup in the Élysée. Clean lines, minimal clutter. There's clearly a generational shift happening.
The security constraints don't care about generations, and this is where the design gets strange. The Oval Office, for example, the windows are made of laminated, bullet-resistant glass. They're also angled and positioned so you can't get a clean sight line from any neighboring building. The desk placement isn't random.
Which tells you something about the Oval itself. It's functional, but it's also the most photographed office on Earth. Every service is a potential backdrop. If you need to think without being a set piece, you go upstairs.
Merkel had a similar pattern, but with a twist. The Grand Chancellor's office, with the 12-meter ceilings, she used it for meetings and official photographs. But her actual working office was a smaller room down the hall, much more modest, where she kept her personal computer and did her reading. Former staff have described her as preferring the smaller space precisely because it didn't feel like a stage.
The pattern across multiple leaders and systems is, the iconic office is real. It gets used. But it's not where the deepest work happens. It's the public-facing layer of a private working stack.
That brings us to the ergonomics question, which is where things get strange. Because you'd think, given the stakes, that these would be the most meticulously optimized workstations on the planet. The best chair. The ideal monitor height. And sometimes that's true, but often it's shockingly not.
Give me the worst example.
There are photographs from Biden's early presidency, widely circulated, showing his Oval Office desk setup. Standard Dell monitor, not particularly large, propped up on what appears to be a stack of hardcover books. No visible ergonomic keyboard. No monitor arm. Paper clutter visible across the desk surface. It looks like a setup a graduate student would have in 2003.
Which is either alarming or refreshing, depending on how you look at it. The most powerful person in the world, and his monitor is sitting on books. Fewer objects, fewer places to hide something.
Israel's threat environment is intense. The Prime Minister's office in Jerusalem is hardened to a degree that most Western leaders' offices aren't. The desk is positioned with clear sight lines to the door. The windows are minimal, and there's almost nothing on the walls that could conceal a device.
Yet it's also a genuine workspace. Visitors describe it as surprisingly modest, but Netanyahu actually uses it. He's known to work late there, reading through documents, taking calls. The austerity is functional, not just symbolic.
Which is the opposite of the German chancellery, where the wide, airy layout creates that massive gap between the desk and the guest seating. That distance isn't a security feature, it's a cultural signal. German business culture values formal distance. You don't get close to the person you're negotiating with. The room enforces that norm before anyone speaks.
I measured it in the photo. It's got to be 12, 15 feet from the desk to the nearest guest chair.
That's intentional. The architect who designed the chancellery, Axel Schultes, was explicit about wanting the building to express democratic transparency, hence all the glass and open space, but also the seriousness and formality of the office. The distance is part of the architecture of respect.
That brings us to the question of who actually designs these spaces, because it's clearly not the person who did your local dental practice.
And this is where most coverage gets it wrong. You'll see articles about the Oval Office redecorating, and they'll frame it like the First Lady hired an interior decorator and picked out some throw pillows. That's not what's happening.
What is happening?
These offices are designed by specialized government agencies working with security-cleared private firms. In the EU, it's the General Services Administration's Office of the Chief Architect. In the UK, it's the Government Property Agency. These are not people who normally do residential interiors.
They're doing embassies and military command centers.
And the designers themselves often come from that world, high-security commercial or institutional design. They've worked on embassies, defense contractor boardrooms, intelligence facilities. They understand blast-resistant materials, acoustic privacy, electromagnetic shielding. Some of them are former engineers or even former intelligence officers who transitioned into design later in their careers.
The person choosing the desk finish also knows how to defeat a laser microphone.
That's not an exaggeration. When the White House Situation Room was renovated, $50 million custom furniture from a Virginia defense contractor, the designers had to account for everything from acoustic dampening to EMP hardening. The same skill set applies to the Oval Office and the private workspaces around it.
What does the actual design process look like? Does the president sit down with a swatch book?
It starts with a threat assessment and a functional brief from the leader's staff. The leader might have input on aesthetics, color palette, furniture style, which paintings go where, but the layout is driven by security and workflow. The desk goes here because the sight lines work, not because it looks good in photographs.
Although sometimes those things align. Bush the Younger had the Oval Office layout adjusted specifically to improve sight lines for television cameras. That's a different kind of security. The security of the image.
Roosevelt, as we mentioned, had the entire office redesigned around his wheelchair. That wasn't about aesthetics either. It was about function. The desk height, the turning radius, the placement of everything, all driven by a specific physical need. But here's what's interesting. The designers who do this work almost never get named publicly.
Which is probably by design.
But there are exceptions. Michael Graves, the architect and designer. He designed the Vice President's office in the 1990s. He was already famous for product design, the Alessi tea kettle, that kind of thing. But he also had experience with institutional work. The firm Hoke has designed multiple state capitol offices. These are serious architectural firms, not decorators.
The Venn diagram is security clearance, institutional design experience, and enough aesthetic sense to make the room not look like a bunker.
That's the balance. And it's harder than it sounds. You're essentially building a hardened facility that has to look like a comfortable office. The Oval Office has bullet-resistant windows, but they can't look like bullet-resistant windows. The acoustic dampening is in the walls, but the walls have to look like normal painted drywall.
Which brings us to the knock-on effect. Because once you've built this space, it starts doing work beyond just housing the leader. The layout itself becomes a diplomatic tool.
This is where the German chancellery gap becomes really interesting. That 12 to 15 feet between the desk and the guest seating. It's not just cultural signaling. It changes the nature of the conversation. You can't have a quiet, intimate negotiation across that distance. You have to project. Everything becomes slightly more formal.
Compare that to some of the Nordic Prime Minister's offices. I've seen photographs of the Danish Prime Minister's office. It's open plan, glass walls, the desk is practically in the middle of the room. Guests sit close, almost side by side.
Which signals collaboration, transparency, flat hierarchy. The Japanese Prime Minister's office, by contrast, is closed, wood-paneled, deeply traditional. The desk is substantial, the seating is arranged with clear hierarchical positioning. You know exactly where you stand. And the choice of artwork, books, personal items. This is all soft diplomacy. When a foreign leader sits down in that office, they're reading the room. What's on the shelves? What's on the walls? A photo of the leader's family sends one signal. A painting of a national landmark sends another. An empty, impersonal office sends a third signal entirely.
The room is a message before anyone speaks.
The people who design these spaces know that. They're not just solving for security and ergonomics. They're designing a stage for international relations. Every object is a potential conversation piece or a potential liability.
What does any of this mean for someone who is not a head of state? Because I assume most of our listeners are not currently commissioning a Faraday cage for their home office.
There are actually a few practical takeaways. The first is the separation we talked about earlier, performance space versus workspace. Most of us have one desk that does everything, video calls, focused work, meetings, paperwork. But these leaders almost universally separate them. The big desk is for show and for meetings. The real work happens somewhere else.
Even if you're somewhere else, it's just a different corner of the same room.
The second takeaway is intentional distance. Measure the gap between where you sit and where guests sit in your office. If you're always finding meetings feel too casual or too formal, that distance might be the variable you haven't considered. Even a foot or two changes the dynamic. Sight lines and acoustics. You don't need a threat assessment to think about what's behind you when you're on a video call, or whether you can hear someone approaching your desk. These leaders optimize for that because they have to. But the rest of us can borrow the principle. Think about what you're facing, what you're exposing, and how sound moves through your space.
The photo album wasn't just a quirky art project. It was a design textbook disguised as a coffee table book.
That's the best kind. If we're pulling practical lessons from this, the first one is the performance space versus workspace split. Most of us have one desk that does everything. Video calls, deep work, meetings, lunch, but these leaders almost universally separate them. The big desk is the stage. The real work happens somewhere else.
The Queen's side table was the extreme version of that. Throne room for the ceremony, hotel desk for the paperwork. You don't need two rooms to borrow the idea. Even a separate surface in the same space, one that faces away from the camera, changes how you use it.
It changes what accumulates on it. Your performance desk stays clean because it has to. Your work desk gets messy because it should. Mess is a sign that thinking is happening.
The second thing I took from the album is the distance thing. I actually went and measured the gap between my desk and the guest chairs after looking at the chancellery photo. It was about 4 feet. I pulled the chairs back another 2, and suddenly meetings felt different, more structured, less casual.
That's the German model. But you could also go the Danish route, pull the chairs closer, angle them so you're not facing each other head on. The point is that distance isn't neutral. It's a dial you can turn.
Most people never touch it. They inherit whatever layout came with the room and never ask what it's communicating.
If you want to design furniture for a SIF, you need to understand that specification, and you need the clearance to even read the classified annexes. The number of interior designers in the United States who hold top secret clearance is vanishingly small.
Who are they?
They work for a handful of specialized firms. Hoke and Gensler both have government divisions that handle classified projects. There are smaller defense contractors, names that don't show up in design magazines, who build custom furniture for these spaces. The Virginia-based firm that did the Situation Room furniture in 2021 is an example.
Use Google Images or Flickr for higher resolution than what I scrape from Reddit, but the principle's the same. Once you have 30 or 40 images of how different people arrange their working lives, you can't unsee the signals.
You realize your own office is making those same signals whether you intended it or not. Their best work is classified. The Situation Room renovation, $50 million, custom everything, and there are no photographs of the finished product available to the public. We know it happened. We know the budget.
I think it becomes more symbolic, not less. The rarer the physical presence, the more weight the room carries when you're actually in it. If a head of state does 90% of their work from a secure residential compound, the 10% that happens in that office becomes pure theater, but theater that matters.
The theater might outlast the function. We're already seeing virtual offices and AI-assisted workflows reshape how executives operate. The next generation of heads of state might not need a physical desk at all. They could govern from a tablet in a CIF with staff distributed across continents.
Which would make the Oval Office something closer to a museum piece that occasionally gets used for bill signings. A heritage site with a working phone line.
Yet I suspect the gravitational pull of the physical room won't disappear. There's something about sitting across from someone in a space designed for power that a hologram can't replicate. The German chancellery gap doesn't work on Zoom.
No, it really doesn't. The distance becomes just awkward framing instead of a diplomatic signal.
The question for the 2030s and 40s isn't whether leaders will have offices. It's whether those offices will be workplaces or pure symbols. And I think the answer is, they'll be symbols that occasionally function as workplaces, which is basically what they are now, just more so.
A slow fade from desk to dais. Which brings us to something we wanted to mention. If you've got photos of your own workspace, or if you've stumbled across interesting images of leader offices we haven't discussed, send them our way. We might feature them in a future episode.
We're curious what people are working with. And if nothing else, you'll start seeing your own desk differently once you've looked at enough of these photographs.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Cold War, linguists working in Guyana mistakenly classified the Wapishana language as having an Omaha-type kinship system, a rare pattern where certain generations are linguistically merged. Before later fieldwork in the 1970s corrected it to a Dravidian-type system, which splits those same generations into distinct terms. The error stood in anthropological literature for nearly two decades.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. We're produced by the unflappable Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Go look at some offices.
See what they're saying.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.